The sweet shop in Llandaff in the year 1923 was the very center of our lives. To us, it was what a bar is to a drunk, or a church is to a bishop. Without it, there would have been little to live for. Sweets were our lifeblood. Roald Dahl, Boy, Tales of Childhood, 1984. Imagine a moment when the sensation of honey or sugar on the tongue was an astonishment, a kind of intoxication. The closest I've ever come to recovering such a sense of sweetness was secondhand, though it left a powerful impression on me even so. I'm thinking of my son's first experience of sugar, the icing on the cake at his first birthday. I have only the testimony of Isaac's face to go by, that and his fierceness to repeat the experience. But it was plain that his first encounter with sugar had intoxicated him, was in fact an ecstasy in the literal sense of that word. That is, he was beside himself with the pleasure of it, no longer here with me in space and time, in quite the same way he had been just a moment before. Between bites, Isaac gazed up at me in amazement. He was on my lap, and I was delivering the ambrosial forkfuls to his gaping mouth, as if to exclaim, "Your world contains this? From this day forward, I shall dedicate my life to it." Michael Pollan, Botany of Desire, 2001. What if Roald Dahl and Michael Pollan are right, that the taste of sugar on the tongue can be a kind of intoxication? Doesn't it suggest the possibility that sugar itself is an intoxicant, a drug? Imagine a drug that can intoxicate us, can infuse us with energy, and can do so when taken by mouth. It doesn't have to be injected, smoked, or snorted for us to experience its sublime and soothing effects. Imagine that it mixes well with virtually every food, and particularly liquids, and that when given to infants, it provokes a feeling of pleasure so profound and intense that its pursuit becomes a driving force throughout their lives. Overconsumption of this drug may have long-term side effects, but there are none in the short term. No staggering or dizziness, no slurring of speech, no passing out or drifting away, no heart palpitations or respiratory distress. When it is given to children, its effects may be only more extreme variations on the apparently natural emotional roller coaster of childhood, from the initial intoxication to the tantrums and whining of what may or may not be withdrawal a few hours later. More than anything, our imaginary drug makes children happy, at least for the period during which they're consuming it. It calms their distress, eases their pain, focuses their attention, and then leaves them excited and full of joy until the dose wears off. The only downside is that children will come to expect another dose, perhaps to demand it, on a regular basis. How long would it be before parents took to using our imaginary drug to calm their children when necessary, to alleviate pain, to prevent outbursts of unhappiness, or to distract attention? And once the drug became identified with pleasure, how long before it was used to celebrate birthdays, a soccer game, good grades at school? How long before it became a way to communicate love and celebrate happiness? How long before no gathering of family and friends was complete without it, before major holidays and celebrations were defined in part by the use of this drug to assure pleasure? How long would it be before the underprivileged of the world would happily spend what little money they had on this drug, rather than on nutritious meals for their families? How long would it be before this drug, as the anthropologist Sidney W. Mintz said about sugar, demonstrated a near invulnerability to moral attack, before even writing a book such as this one was perceived as the nutritional equivalent of stealing Christmas?